issues, especially the minutes.
Good afternoon. Can you all hear me okay? Why don't we begin with a little, very short little chant, since we've already heard tons of chanting today. And then maybe we can just sit for a few minutes. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. Om Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good afternoon. It's great to see everybody here today. So here in the room, we got Mary Alessino.
Hey, guys.
Elsa, Deborah Bond, Tom Pantaleone, Chris Dillon, me, Derek, Nancy Carden, Eric, and Inez. And then on screen, we got Oops, Debbie Feldman. We have Barbara Brooks. We have Eileen Mahawald. We have Sue Wolpert. And we have Thomas Mitchell. We have Mary Beth McMurray. We have Cynthia Spencer. And we have, oh, we can't spotlight somebody whose video is off. Brent Kite is with us, invisible. He drank the invisible potion. And Emily Waters in New Zealand. So cool. Great to see everybody. Did everybody experience Ponlop Rinpoche's presentation? I thought, since the main readings that I was circulating were by Ponlop Rinpoche and that event happened at this time, that it might make sense to watch it. It was an hour longer than it was promoted to be. So we're a little bit cut short with the rest of whatever we're going to do today, which I'll try to figure out how to adjust as we go. But it might make sense to spend a few minutes talking about what he just talked about, since it was such a wonderful overview of what we're doing here. So Ponlop Rinpoche was speaking on as a guest of Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche's community called Tergar. And it was being featured as an open talk as part of the year-long Path of Liberation program that Mingyur Rinpoche, help me out, which program? Path of Liberation, Path of...
It's not really Path of Liberation. It's a year-long, what he calls transmission. This is, every year he has sort of like a theme that he's transmitting. So it was not all, because Path of Liberation is restricted. That's his later part of Path. This was, the first half was open and some of the later part was somewhat restricted. So it was a mix, but it's a year-long transmission of Mahamudra based on the Ganges Mahamudra.
Thank you, Cynthia. That was so helpful. I've been trying for 9 months to figure that out. I was confused by the mix of restricted and unrestricted, and like how this fits in. In the meantime, I get about 3 emails from Tergar every day of various programs. So the two of them, Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche and Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche, whose community is called Nalanda Bodhi, if you're interested in pursuing his teachings further, are the two main teachers today that are presenting the tradition of Mahamudra as it's brought down to us in this day and age through what's called the Karmakagyu lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. When we say Karmakagyu tradition of Buddhism, of Tibetan Buddhism, we mean that within the Kagyu tradition, it's the Karmakagyu branch of that tradition. And so there's 4 great and 8 lesser branches of the Kagyu tradition, and the Karma is one of the 4 greater. And it's represented by the line, the lineage of Karmapas, and the individuals who act as the Karmapas regent in between Karmapas, which has included Jomkun Kongchuls, Situs, Gelsops, Shamar Rinpoches, and a number of other individuals since the first Karmapa in the 11th century. So this is the lineage that we receive from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was from what's called the Sermon Kagyu tradition, and Sermon is the name of the area in Tibet that he is from, and he's from one of a number of monasteries in Sirmaung district of Tibet, and his monastery, Dutsi Til, was the second largest in that region, the first, the largest, and the main holder of the Sirmaung Kagyu tradition is the Namgyeltse Monastery. And Sirmaung is famous for a branch of Mahamudra that was sort of put on the map by the fourth Trungpa, Khunga Namgyel, who wrote a many hundred page text on Mahamudra, which became quite famous and is currently being translated and will be published eventually through Wisdom Publications by its president, Daniel Eiken, and his wife, whose name escapes me. And it will be presented and taught by Garwang Rinpoche, who is the other third teacher presenting Karma Kagyu Mahamudra, and he's the head of the Namgyeltse Monastery of the Sirmaung branch. Pandlip Rinpoche was commenting overtly on a key text that comes down to us in the Mahamudra tradition. So let's do a little like Q&A and have some discussion. So feel free to chime in. I think we can hear people okay on this one. So we'll see. So what was the text that Rinpoche was commenting on mainly? And it was a little confusing because he commented on two different texts. Sue.
I think it was the Prajnaparamita Sutra and then the King of Genuine Dharma Sutra.
Right, so those are the two sutras that he was citing references from in support of, what was his agenda that he was getting at?
To try to ensure that everybody knew that they originally came from India, from the Buddha.
Thank you, from the Buddha. What is they? What is it you said, that they originally came from the Buddha?
So that, I guess, the population at large.
No. What is the they? What is it that came from the Buddha?
Oh, Mahamudra.
Mahamudra teachings, right? Was somebody doubting him? Was one of you doubting him? And is that why he felt compelled to to promote that?
Yes.
You were doubting
I was
him?
Because in our readings, the term Mahamudra.
Can you guys hear Chris at all?
Good. Yes.
The term Mahamudra, from what I've been reading, comes up later, but then I thought, but the essence of it goes back to the Buddha, obviously. So maybe we could just say it's a later term that they came up with to describe what the Buddha was already describing.
Well, I think it was in one of the sutras that he quoted, right? The actual term Mahamudra.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sutras are all, were they all spoken by the Buddha? There's a lot of, that's a lot of sutras. That's a lot of teachings.
Yeah.
I mean, he was enlightened for what, 35 years after, until he died? 45 years. Sorry, 46 years. Barbara, you're muted. And then Nancy here. Nancy.
The first big point he first made was lineage. Presented that loud and clear in the beginning, that this is about lineage.
Yeah, what did he say about lineage? What was the point he was
he
making?
To the different teachers, and then, but it was all going back to the Buddha, so there were teachers.
He rattled off a bunch of names, right, lineage. To show where it was coming from. With Muhammad
well, I
tradition.
Think that especially when Cynthia was pointing out that the goal is about a transmission, it's important to make sure that the lineage is unbroken, that's so it's a direct transmission from the Buddha, like from the, I don't know, that's how I read it.
Just yeah. AI, Google.
Yeah, like someone's just not making it up.
Yeah.
The Buddhists are very into that, right? Like just making sure it's directly coming from the Buddha, which is
authentic.
That's great. Thank you, Kelsey. You guys at home hear that? Okay, cool. So he was using those two sutras to support his point that the Mahamudra teachings originated with the Buddha. He was making the assumption that the Buddha actually spoke all the Mahayana sutras, which maybe not everybody in the world agrees with. But towards the end, he then turned towards the text that he was actually supposed to teach on, which was what?
The Ganges Mahamudra?
The Ganges Mahamudra. What is this Ganges Mahamudra? What's the full title or explanation of that?
Oh,
that's like shorthand, right?
Well, that it was taught, I guess, on the banks of the Ganges River by Tilopa, to Naropa.
Thank you. Yes. So this is a very famous text in the Kagyu transmission of Mahamudra. Is this text that comes from Tilopa to Naropa, taught legendarily on the banks of the Ganges River in northeastern India.
Because they did a lot of grains of sand to illustrate the points.
That's right. Do rivers have sand? I guess that river has sand in its banks, yeah. Tom?
What form of the Mahamudra effect is there?
Yeah, so Tom asked, what form of Mahamudra was that considered? And I ask you all, what are the possible form? Tom is referring to that there are some possible different forms of Mahamudra. What are those forms?
Sutra,
Tantra,
and essence.
Sutra, Tantra, and essence. All right. And what is Sutra Mahamudra?
No,
Mahamudra
talks through the sutras.
That's what we're studying.
Right. But what is it? So Mahamudra taught through the sutras.
It's I'm sorry. And it's also Mahamudra that is not reliant on any ritual or abhisheka or anything like that.
Well, let's come back to that. Debbie.
Yeah, let's come back to that.
Except maybe point out.
Oh, let's talk about that. What did you have?
Well, I mean, he said, even though it doesn't depend on abhishekas, then not 10, 15 minutes later, he said you still have to have pointing out instructions to practice it, even the sutra, Mahamudra.
Yeah, I caught that too, which is actually different than it's presented by him, I think, in his book, Wild Awakening, and other places. Sutra Mahamudra is based on the cultivation of what faculty? Devotion. Devotion in the Tibetan tradition, that Gampopa creates this scheme of these three and says that Sutra Mahamudra can be transmitted to students based on intense, genuine devotion pointing out transmission is actually not required. So I was a little surprised and miffed to hear him say that.
The devotion to, would it be the guru?
It could be the guru, it could be the Dharma, it could be the Buddha, or it could be all three. Debbie.
Yeah, you said you just used the phrase being miffed at hearing something. I was a little miffed when somebody, I don't remember if it was him or the translator, said that it's not long out, the four qualities needed. And somebody said, being intelligent. Oh, yes. God. By the way, hi, I am Debbie Frederick, not intelligent.
There was some disagreement in the room about the veracity of that comment. The last part of it, that is. Sue.
Well, one of the things he called the sutra tradition was the secret path, and the impression that I had in relation to the guru would be that it's like you're being, it's like you have to, it's there written, but to me. What?
We lost. You froze right at the crucial moment there.
Oh, well, I can't tell you what I was going to say.
Yeah, it's secret, right?
Yeah, just that you, the teacher, you might look at it and not see what there is to be seen, but if you are taught it,
it's that's right, and it,
going it, on he, a path. So you are
he talks about that secrecy in his book, Wild Awakening, and in a chapter that we went through in one of these sessions earlier, one of the earlier of these monthly sessions, where he talks about the secret route through the city, right? Only the certain, only the Sikh cab drivers know that route to the airport, right? And so you need somebody knowledgeable and capable to point that out to you. And he's referring to the fact that Mahamudra is pointed out in the sutras, and he was using, there was a verse on screen of it being secret, self-secret, where he said it's right there, but if you don't actually know the meaning of it or the full intention of it, then it remains a secret. He said the essence of Sutra Mahamudra is Prajnaparamita. What is Prajnaparamita?
Transcendental wisdom.
Now, what does transcendental wisdom know that regular wisdom doesn't? To come to it being it, the wisdom of what?
Mind.
Nature.
What's the big thing in the Prajnaparamita sutras that they talk about over and over again? Nothing. Emptiness. They also talked about luminosity. So then he made a number of points about Mahamudra using excerpts from these sutras. And the first was that about something about the essence of one's mind, I think, as being Mahamudra and being like what? What did he say about the nature of mind?
It's always in this moment. It's
okay.
Nowhere else but this moment.
Your mind is always in the present. That's good.
On the essence, maybe I misunderstood Father and saying something about can't teach that. But maybe he was saying it can't be taught. Was that what he was?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
What else? He talked about something, some other word that starts with a D. Oh. Derek, dogs.
I had free.
And our mind is naturally. Yeah, Dharma Dhatu. He also used another Dharma, Dharmakaya, right? That our mind is Dharmakaya. That the true nature of our mind is like Dharmakaya. And that's the secret, is that our mind seems to be full of kleshas, but really the true nature of our mind is Dharmakaya. And then he gave some examples from the sutras. One was the wrestler with the jewel. What was the idea of that example?
That if you can't find your glasses, look on the top of your head.
And if you're going to wrestle, put your favorite jewel in a safe place beforehand or something.
Right.
Not looking outside, right?
Yeah.
Not looking outside your own mind for enlightenment, right? That in Dharmakaya, true nature, enlightenment, Buddha, is right in your own mind. You don't have to look outside. And one part of the story he left out is they say that the wrestler is very fat and big and has like all these folds in his forehead. You might have wondered, like, how could he lose a jewel? And it cut. So the idea is that he's got all these folds and somehow it got cut and pushed in. It's a stretch. It's a stretch.
Yeah,
that's Kelsa.
Doesn't also say that.
Oh, hold on 1 second, Sue.
In the Heart Sutra, doesn't it also say confusion is Dharmakaya? Right. So I just want to point out though that it's like both aspects. It's not just that sort of like non-conceptual part, which is like true natural mind, right? Like without the conception. But then the confusion itself, which is the conceptual overlay and fog, is also a part of the Dharmakaya. And that's why you don't want to push away any of the thoughts or say that that's like wrong or bad, because it's all like a part of the Buddha nature, which I think is what we were saying, that like typically there's a confusion in Western society that we want to like remove our thoughts, like the thoughts are bad. So I find that part really helpful, actually, with Mahamudra.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a major point of the understanding, the view of working with our mind, is that conceptual mind is not an obstacle. Thoughts, kleshas are not an obstacle and are not separate from Dharmakaya.
Obstacles are not obstacles.
They're opportunities. what was the next analogy that he read from the sutra? I'm doing this just because it's not, you know, when you hear talks, it's hard to retain the stuff, and yeah. I thought it might be helpful to let go.
He told a story about the two couples. I don't know if that was the next one. Eating coconut fork?
Yeah, that was the next example. There was one in between. Yeah, that was a funny story, right? It all depends on your point of view.
This is if you remember things better if you have a story.
that's why he told stories. That's why I'm hoping you remember this, the second analogy.
Sand, couples, jewel. Sand.
First there was the jewel, and then there was...
Oh, sand, yes.
That wasn't a big story.
That was just the grains of sand in the Ganges Mahamudra.
About 1,000 grains.
Is it dark in here? Should we like turn the lights on more?
I'm fine.
Oh, that was a hint.
Oh.
Oh, about a light illuminating.
Yeah.
The darkest of containers.
Well, there was two parts to it. There was
the
two
darkness,
parts.
No matter how long it's been there,
right?
It's illuminated.
Darkness. It's like if it's dark for a day or for like an aeon, it doesn't have any greater ability to repel light, right? Instantly. So, what is that an analogy for?
Awakening.
In what way?
The confusion gets dissipated instantly.
Instantly, no matter.
How long
you've been confused, or
how confused you've been,
or how confused you are, how much confusion there is, it immediately dissipates.
Confusion is also in their mind.
That's why it dissipates so quickly.
But that would be when you see the containers with.
Well, that was the second part. That was the second part. So what? How did he get to the? What was that second part?
Well,
what were the different jars? And then now, no, it was more than that.
All the jars?
Yeah.
So if you see the emptiness,
thank you. Right. So as soon as you turn on the light and understand the nature of the mind, then you understand the nature of all phenomena. And that's part of why we focus on the mind, is because by understanding the nature of the mind, we understand everything, as opposed to like meditate on the emptiness of some object that I'm attached to, you know.
Wouldn't that be easier? It's complicated.
It's not as fruitful.
The
emptiness
of a stick.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not really attached to sticks, but yeah. Like, what are we attached to?
Just one.
Right.
Another
Right, and then he came back to the Ganges Mahamudra and talked about the qualities of the student. And I think intelligent means, as opposed to it meaning like if your IQ is below a certain number, you need to do a different pass.
Yeah.
is that if you're willing, it's more, I think, like if you're willing to use your natural intelligence. And that may seem like an odd thing to say, but some of us, maybe many of us, come to the path from difficult circumstances, and we just want to meditate as a way of dealing with those circumstances. And initially, we may not feel or think like we have to use our intellect. I thought we're getting away from our intellect. We're just meditating here. Why do you want me to study all this stuff, you know? So I will rely on devotion. There you go. So I don't have to understand everything. I'll just rely on devotion. That's that's an option. Anything else about Bunlop Rinpoche's presentation? The essence of Mahamudra?
Did we already talk about the... There was some kind of reading in a sutra. It was about how the mind isn't, true nature of the mind is not stained.
I think we did at the beginning that.
That's the Ganges sand.
Go on.
Like if all the beings in the world did bad activities for eons, it wouldn't change the nature of mind.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he was talking about
that.
That was the
sand. Yeah, so that's right. That was early on in terms of.
So the mind doesn't generate the mind. It's uncontrived, which is natural.
Right. So going back to the three types of Mahamudra, in other places, the three types are presented where Sutra Mahamudra is based on understanding Prajnaparamita Sutras, emptiness primarily. And let's come back to luminosity. And then Mantra Mahamudra is based on Abhisheka, the practices that are affiliated with the different, he mentioned the different numbered Abhishekas. And there's an affiliation of different practices, tantric practices, with the different Abhishekas. There's four Abhishekas, and there's different practices affiliated with them. And then essence Mahamudra usually means the one that's based on transmission, pointing out transmission, which gives us the opportunity to focus on Sutra Mahamudra without transmission. But we'll sort of hedge that given today's presentation. Nancy?
Now, I have a question about Abhisheka. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could define that. I connect that with Tantra?
Yes.
So, but however, this practice is, so it's a little confusing to me. It's like it's a bridge, it's both. It's in this lifetime you can do Mahamudra and be realize you don't need to go into whatever the practices are of the Tantra. So that's confusing to me.
Yeah, so that's the idea of having these three different types of Mahamudra. Is that there's Sutra Mahamudra, where one can practice Mahamudra without having to receive Abhisheka and do the formal Abhisheka practices that Abhisheka entails. Abhisheka is an empowerment, and the essence of the empowerment is introducing you to and welcoming you into the mandala of a certain deity. So there's Abhishekas for entering the disciple into the mandala of a deity. And it's always oriented in that way. And then you would do practices oriented towards that deity. And it has that level of secrecy because the deity's mandalas are kept secret to those who haven't entered into them, because the mandalas reveal all sorts of very effective and explicit and also complicated and demanding practices that are involved with becoming one, union with that deity. Deities being the manifestation of different aspects of enlightened energy or enlightened being. Some number of people are going to be getting the Vajrayogini Abhisheka soon, and they'll be introduced into the mandala of Vajrayogini. And then the practices begin with the assumption that one has done the preliminary practices of Nandrola, prostrations, mantra, mandala, and guru yoga. And then having received Abhisheka, one does the sadhana of Vajrayogini and visualizes oneself as Vajrayogini. You're empowered to practice the visualization of yourself as Vajrayogini Chris.
So the writings that go along with that, is that considered chant, a sadhana?
The writings that go along with that practice are considered a liturgy.
Liturgy.
Yeah, so there's the liturgy, it's a story. It literally is a story with lots of things that you're supposed to repeat and describes visualizations. And there's all sorts of poems in it that praise the qualities of that deity or that, and others that express the nature of reality that is revealed by that deity and so forth. And then the second scheme of practices after Abhisheka are the inner yoga practices of the inner heat, dumo, and luminosity, or illusory body practice, dream yoga practice, clear light practice. Those are the four root dharmas of the six dharmas of Naropa, which is his distillation of the 12 different teachings that Taloba gave him. And those are very complicated, difficult inner yoga practices. And then the third set of practices from the Abhisheka involve further elaborations that one does after having done the inner yoga practices. And then the fourth group of practices that one does related to that Abhisheka are Mahamudra. And so that's the Mahamudra that's based on mantra. So one would do that Mahamudra practice after having gone through the sadhana practice of Vajrayogini, visualizing yourself as Vajrayogini, and then as your Vajrayogini, visualizing all the inner aspects of the subtle body, the chakras and the nadis and the pranas and the bindus, and all sorts of stuff going on in the inner body with some level of efficacy or accomplishment in those practices. And then based on that, one would do Mahamudra practice. So that's a very long path. And the third type of Mahamudra is essence Mahamudra, which is just like the ability to connect spontaneously, which normally is presented as what happens in transmission. And that based on transmission of pointing out the nature of one's mind, one would then be able to practice Mahamudra practice, which ultimately is the practice of coming to understand the nature of one's mind, which I think brings us to focusing on what we might do here today for the remainder of our time at 3:42. So any final comments or questions about what Punlabhimshe presented or anything subsequent that we just discussed before we dive into today's material? Okay. So today's session, the idea, my intention for this is to work together with everyone who's participating to gain the experience of Mahamudra Shamatha.
And Mahamudra Shamatha is the foundational practice in Mahamudra. And Mahamudra Vipassana is the path or the subsequent practice in Mahamudra of all types, or I guess you might say of sutra and mantra. Mahamudra essence is supposed to be a little bit more instantaneous, but depending on how you understand it. The Vipassana practice revolves around working with, the Vipassana, Mahamudra Vipassana is focused on understanding the nature of mind as Dharmakaya. And once we understand mind, we experience, not only understand, and I think probably everybody at this point has been exposed to this threefold scheme way of understanding how we progress on the path. We gain understanding initially through study and practice. Through further study and practice, we gain experience of what we have understood, such as what are some of the things that we begin to experience early on in our path, our practice of the path of Buddhism. Maitri, loving kindness. We experience loving kindness. Thoughts. We gain direct experience of the the omnipresence of thoughts. That's good. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else? Sue.
Impermanence, really.
Thank you. Impermanence. I was looking for that. Oh. That's great. Yeah, you know, some basic Buddhist teachings, like, you know, impermanence. We're getting old as we go along trying to practice this path. We're getting old. We begin to experience directly impermanence, suffering. And what's the third mark of
egolessness.
Yeah. Yeah, so egolessness is like a particular case of the general topic of the third mark, which is identitylessness or essencelessness. And sometimes this has a range of experiences, I think, that include at some points in our life, I'm sure we have all experienced this sense of futility, of like, what is the meaning of life? It's like, you know, at some point it begins not to make sense. And maybe that's because we've been brought up in this whole context of thinking or being taught that life is about X, Y, and Z, and gradually realizing, well, those don't really turn out the way that I thought they were going to turn out. And so then we go into this outer space of like, so then what is the point of life? And that's a great transition point, and that's actually a very helpful experience for the path, I think, because then we have to figure out, you know, it's a little bit of a glimpse of emptiness, right? It's like, what's the point of all this, of the wealth and cars and possessions and achievements? What is the point? And so then it helps us follow that trail to figuring out what is the point of life. And hopefully in our conclusion to that, we include gaining enlightenment as at least part of the point of life. Because we're all going to die. And if you're not terrified of death, you should spend some time thinking about it, because nobody knows what the hell is going to happen at death. You could be reborn as an insect. You could go through a really horrific bardo state if you're not able to remain present and aware when you're done.
But it's only our mind stream.
You're right. It's not a problem. It's, yeah.
I'm not coming back as anything.
All right.
This is true, but our mind stream could end up, you know, spending aeons as a hell being, you know?
Did I miss the third?
Essencelessness and egolessness is the is one type of essencelessness. Yeah, we come to see that too. We come to experience that too, right? Oh, I'm sorry. So the third stage of our development on the path. So then through experience, we then develop realization. And so the idea ultimately is that we're coming to understand the nature of mind by first having confidence in what we're being told, that everything comes from the mind. And we have to think about this a little bit. And we don't need to, in my personal opinion, we don't need to spend a lot of time thinking about whether that means that the external world doesn't exist or not. Because the point of it is that all happiness and suffering are in the mind. And sure, the body plays a huge role in that, but how we relate to body suffering is it the major factor in our experience, our happiness and sadness. So we need to work on the mind. And then we're told that the nature of the mind is the key to experiencing enlightenment by understanding the nature of mind. So we use those three stages as the context for exploring mind, understanding mind. And ideally, we spend some time reading and thinking about what are the different aspects of mind. What are some aspects of mind? What is mind?
Unborn.
I'm sorry?
I said unborn.
Unborn. You can't find like where it started, right?
Well,
empty freedom.
So in the room here, Kelsa is saying that its mind is luminous and
clear, aware, clear.
It's clear and aware.
And it also is like, it's like that empty quality of, I don't know what the term is, but losing it, but
it's empty.
Yeah.
Sue, what did you have? What is your mind like?
Well, we've covered it already. It's empty, moving, and aware.
So these are things that we've been taught, right? What's our direct experience of our mind?
Phenomenon.
It drives us crazy, right? It incessantly obsesses about the same things. Maybe that's just mine.
I think it's all these objects.
Well, so is so we learn.
This is a. Yeah, so we learn about the quality, the nature of the mind, the different aspects.
Yeah.
And we learn, you know, we have a direct experience of our mind as being neurotic, right? But then we come to understand, oh, it has these fundamental aspects. It's empty, it has no essence. It's clear, it's luminously reflecting whatever appears in it.
It's not neurotic.
What is the it that's not neurotic?
Mind.
Well, let's come back to that. That just made you're calling the same thing two different things.
No, mind itself.
Mind itself.
Mind itself.
Ordinary mind.
Okay, we'll come back to mind itself. So then the third aspect was that it's aware all the time, right? It's constantly aware. So it has no essence. It clearly reflects whatever comes in its purview.
Where is learning?
Learning is understanding.
No, but in terms of those three. So like we learn something. We learn about the skandhas, or we learn about these six curiosities, or whatever you want to call it. You learn about the three and the four, all that. And then you actually learn it, and then you're experiencing. But what is learning? Like is, I don't know.
Learning is understanding, is an accumulation of information within which we hope to achieve understanding. So we learn about the nature of mind. We learn about it through through it, our own experience of our mind. We learn about it through hearing people tell us about their mind. and then we experience, but mostly our experience of the nature of our mind is not empty, vividly clear, and constantly aware, right? You know, if you ask the Joe on the street what is the nature of the mind, I don't think they would come up with that. So we learn about these qualities and we understand what they mean, hopefully to some extent, but we don't necessarily experience them, at least right away, right? So gradually we, through meditation practice in conjunction with the study, ideally we begin to experience those qualities of mind, experiencing the empty quality of mind, experiencing the clear reflective quality of mind, and experiencing the continually aware quality of mind.
And we could add into that that we experience sometimes some of those things in the form of what they call experiences or yam, where we may mistake them for being some kind of realization, but they're really not, you know, they definitely fall into the middle category, the second category, not the third. But it's a common mistake that when we experience, whether it's some kind of feeling of well-being or a, you know, joy or whatever that might be that falls into the bliss category, or some kind of clarity, you know, the sense that one can really know, or the sense of occasional absence of thought or lack of conceptuality. And then we may think, you know, I mean, it's great. These are like glimpses of the next stage, but we sometimes mistake them for being like, oh, you know, this is enlightenment. I must be there.
Yeah, so on the path of meditation, there's a set of three experiences that traditionally happen to us as we pursue meditation practice, in particular shamatha practice, which Cynthia is referring to. And it's the experience of well-being or joy, which in the traditional text is called bliss. It's the culmination of that positivity that comes out of meditation practice. And then there's clarity or luminosity. And then there's non-thought. So how do we experience these in our meditation practice? What is the non-thought experience?
Oh, it's a spacious, empty feeling.
It's that gap that we just experienced, right?
And in the beginning, you experience that gap and you get a smile. Like, then you try and grab it. It's like, oh, where'd it go? I want that back.
Right. Well, that's what Cynthia is talking about, is that we have these little glimpses of these experiences of, oh, there was a nice gap. I had that, like, that meditation session went so fast, right? It's like, whoa, that was, how long was that? That was 30 minutes. That seemed like 5 minutes, right? Because we have that gap. And then we're like hoping that we're going to have that every time, right? And we think that we've realized how to experience that. But in fact, it's a temporary experience, not a realization. And the hankering after that experience produces an obstacle, actually, towards our experiencing it further. How do we experience the so-called bliss in meditation?
Wow.
I don't know. Haven't got there yet, right? What is the bliss quality? What is this, the joy, well-being?
Just have some free time from the crazy world.
Yes. What is our experience of that one of the three aspects? How does that manifest in our own personal experience?
I know it's connected with compassion.
But I'm not relating that. I'm not trying to relate them with that. I'm just saying, like, how have you experienced bliss in your meditation practice? And the word bliss.
Letting go?
Letting go, yeah. Yeah, like little glimpses of, like, oh, I don't need to think about that anymore. Or as Inez says, like if our life is very chaotic, getting to the cushion and having time alone, it can be very joyful, right? So those are little experiences of joy that may increase, and you may get like a very powerful experience of joy. And again, sort of cling to that, thinking that you've realized how to connect spontaneously with joy, and then it doesn't happen because it's only on the level of experience.
Then as soon as we let go of the clinging,
no, like whatever, we experience it again.
So this teaching is no matter, you know, it's just like we exist in that.
That's right.
We're not judging that.
That's
we let
right.
Go, we chuckle.
So what's the clarity? What's the clarity aspect that we experience in meditation? How does that manifest in our meditation practice?
It's just the absence of feeling like we have to figure anything out.
Yeah.
That sounds more like letting go to me. But
it's awareness, the aware awake quality.
But what is your
remembering
experience of that?
Remembering the instructions.
Yeah. So clarity, like understand, like we have these flashes of like, oh, that's why I keep the eyes open in meditation. Oh, that's why we label thinking, because otherwise I would be thinking all the time. Or, oh, that's why he or she did that X, Y, and Z. It's that level of insights that occur in meditation practice. We have these little experiences of being able to see, have larger perspective on our experience. But just like space, you know, you see, oh, I really screwed that up, didn't I?
Oh, that's what he meant.
Yeah. For me, like, clarity is all of a sudden you've uncluttered your mind. And so you have a lot of room now to see other things and make connections.
Yeah.
You can stop kind of protecting yourself for a while. So once you stop protecting yourself,
that's the letting go. That's the joy.
Yeah, but
what
all
you see,
kinds of things can come in and you can open to.
So then how do these, here's a little exercise that I think is helpful, is that basically there's these many sets of three in the Buddhist tradition. And I think a lot of them correlate and it's helpful to understand. So we just went through two sets of three. One of them was the three fundamental aspects of mind, which were empty of essence, luminous in nature, and constantly knowing. So then we have these three experiences in meditation. We have bliss, luminosity, and emptiness. Oh, sorry, non-thought. I just gave it away, darn. Yeah.
I think we knew what
was. So obviously the non-thought is an experience of the empty quality of mind. What is the the luminous clarity aspect of mind is an experience of the is that experience of luminosity, of clarity, of knowing, right, of seeing things clearly. And that leaves the correlation of bliss or joy with what? Well, I described luminosity is a little bit vague the way I described it. Sorry. So there's like insight that happens, clarity, luminosity. And then there's the knowing quality of mind. So which one of those is joy?
Is the knowing what you're talking about is awareness? It's just
it's
awareness. So that's that one, isn't it?
I think so. I think the awareness aspect of mind is what leads to the experience of joy. And the
clarity is that.
And the clarity, luminosity is the insight, but things appearing clearly.
Awareness is in the concept of knowing?
Yeah. So then there's the three marks of existence we went through. Do those correlate? What does essencelessness correlate to?
Emptiness.
Empty.
An empty aspect of mind, right? What is the the suffering correlate to?
Constantly knowing.
The bliss. Right?
Really?
And then impermanence correlates to clear appearance, luminosity. All phenomena are impermanent and clearly appearing. I don't know, something like that. And then we have the three doors of liberation. Have you heard of the three doors of liberation? Door number 1, 2, and 3. And we have the whirlpool washing machine.
I think door number 3.
Yes.
The three gates.
The three gates to enlightenment. Three ways to achieve enlightenment is the path of emptiness, the gate of door of liberation of emptiness. Do you want me to close that? Is that sun too much?
Yeah.
And the Dharma door or gate of liberation of emptiness correlates obviously with the empty essence of mind and the experience of non-thought. And then the other two Dharma doors of liberation are, oh, that's the wrong one to put down, isn't it? That's the Dharma door, right? Oh, not that one either. Is signlessness and signlessness, which is an odd word, signlessness. There's no signs, right? Like there's no stop signs. No, the Dharma door of emptiness goes with emptiness. So there's signlessness. So these two we have to match up.
Ooh. And wishlessness.
And wishlessness. So what do you think the wishlessness affiliates with?
And bliss, I'm guessing.
The bliss. Yeah, the feeling of bliss.
Are these three things again?
These are the three gates to enlightenment. The three Dharma doors to enlightenment are emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness.
Have these still relate to the other three emptiness?
They all do. They do. That's what I'm doing. Yeah.
Okay.
The emptiness, obviously, is the empty quality of mind and the experience of non-thought. And then the wishlessness is the experience of bliss and arises from the quality of constantly knowing, I think. And then the quality of impermanent luminous appearance is the quality of signlessness. Instead of fixating on things as having characteristics, we see that things are beyond characteristics.
That luminous?
That's the luminous quality.
Can you provide us with a chart?
So it's the clarity, because I always learned emptiness, clarity, let's see, openness, clarity, openness. So openness is emptiness. And so it's bliss, clarity?
Do you want the inner, bliss is knowing, I think. This is, yeah, we should shift.
Okay.
Do you like the inner one up or do you care or what?
Okay.
Whatever. Okay. So what I was building towards is that in the first one of these sessions, and you see it on the cover page here, I gave the list of readings from the other sections because I'm sort of hoping that they link together and you might revisit them. And I do have copies of the first one if anyone here physically didn't get a copy and wants one.
In the first one, Mark Schur?
Yeah. Yeah. So, here's that.
Are you talking about the reading packages here?
I am. That are listed on the front page. So, no, 1D from that package was a text called The Instruction on Stillness, Occurrence, and awareness. And so that's a text by Meepom Rinpoche.
You sent these to us.
I did originally. Yeah, you have these. Yeah. So I just wanted to, I consider that to be a really helpful reference point for what is our practice of Mahamudra. Because he succinctly identifies a scheme that, from what I've seen, all of the different Mahamudra manuals ultimately use. And he says in this, if you can simply practice Mahamudra and experience stillness, occurrence, and awareness according to the vital instruction of that practice, you will ultimately perceive the truth of reality. This is because the nature of your mind has the Sugata essence. Apply the related key instructions. The basis of all things is mind. So the key instructions. So that was the view. I'm sorry, the practice is focusing on is cultivating the experience of stillness, occurrence, and awareness, right? It's not in today's packet.
Not in. No.
You have today's.
From the first read.
The first read. The first one.
It's okay. I'm going to read it. You know, it's very simple. So if you can simply practice Mahamudra and through that practice experience stillness, occurrence, and awareness. Stillness. So this is the scheme that they repeat over and over and over again. And I think from the way they present it, it's crucial in order to do a Mahamudra Vipassana. Because this is the scheme that they use in Mahamudra Vipassana, which is focused on understanding the true nature of mind as Dharmakaya, is that the Vipassana practices go looking at the nature of stillness, of the still mind, looking at the nature of the moving mind, which here is called occurrence, and then seeing that they're not different. Okay? So those two types of mind. And so there's a lot to understand in that presentation. First is that occurrence means any content of mind. And that includes whatever you consider to be thoughts, whatever you consider the word thought to include. Thoughts can include memories, plans, just the sort of internal dialogue that we all have, intentions, plans, analysis, right? Thoughts, many different types of thoughts, right? And then there's sense perceptions. And sense perceptions range from internal feelings that we have in our body, physical feelings that we experience physically, and then the other five senses, smells, tastes, sounds, and vision, visuals. So those are all occurrence also. And that's the second type of occurrence, which sometimes we call thoughts, right? When we teach shama, you know, our meditation technique, initially we say everything's a thought, label it thinking. But they sort of break it up into these three categories, and the sense perceptions are the second category. The third category, what's the third category, anyone?
Occurrence?
Yeah. Damn it.
Yeah.
Awareness.
Consciousness.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm so upset.
Awareness.
Emotions.
Yeah. We're still in the number two.
No, number three. So there's thoughts, and then there's sense perceptions and emotions. Feelings or emotions, yeah. Well, feelings a tricky one because it's also differently
and
sconded. That's right. So those are the three objects that are used in Vipassana to understand the nature of mind as Dharmakaya and thereby dispel the darkness of a thousand aeons in an instant, is pairing up these three sets of things. And on the one hand, it's always the still mind, and then it's the thinking mind, and then it's the sense perceptions, and then it's the emotions. So in all of those cases, there's an analysis of mind as having these different experiences of different types of content, of thoughts, sense experience, and emotions. These are all called mental content. And they're summed up here in this text by Mipham with the word occurrence, and in other places translated as movement. So movement has these three varieties in the Mahamudra Vipassana tradition. Movement or occurrence includes thoughts, sense perceptions, and emotions. And in each case, the looking is looking at the nature of each of those three and the nature of the stillness, and seeing that they're not different. And in my opinion, in my experience, I was confused for many years of what is the stillness? And I kept thinking, well, this, because they say you gain the experience or the understanding of the stillness by practicing shamatha. And I thought that the stillness meant when my mind does not have content in it, that that's the still mind. And that then we look at the still mind in the Vipassana practice. So we're cultivating the still mind without content.
Does that mean gap to you?
Right, that's what I used to think it meant.
What do you think now?
So now I think that what they're doing is that the still mind is the experience that we all have of there being a container within which movement happens. Whether there's movement or not. And really the acknowledgement is there's always movement. But even when there's movement, you can look at different parts of your mind. And that's the key part, is that you can look at the still part of your mind, which is the container, or you can look at the contents. And they, in other places, they use this language of the container and the contained, or the environment and its contents. So we have this feeling. We all have this feeling. Our mental world is like filled with thoughts and memories and dreams and plans and emotions, and it is within our mental world. We have this idea that our mental world is like this container, and if you learn Buddhism, you probably think of the Alivijnana, the storehouse consciousness. It's all like within that. Chris.
I'm just going to take for analogy, it's like the Christmas globes. Snowball things you shake up.
That's right.
It's like you could either be following all those flakes or just watching them all go all over the place.
Yeah, so I used to think that in that analogy, you know, there's a globe filled with liquid and with flakes inside, right? And you shake it up and the flakes. And I thought, okay, the flakes are the movement, are the content. And the content moves around the thoughts, emotions and sense perceptions, and then the stillness is the water, the liquid inside. But I think the stillness is the globe, is the container. Eric.
Oh, yeah, interestingly, because I feel like I wrestle with this every time I sit, basically.
What do they mean by this?
the actual instructions from Dzogchen Rinpoche originally, and I've read time and time again in some of his readings, is that, like, actually what you do is, like, you know, do the 7-point posture, you know, straighten your back, do all that stuff, and you're immediately in stillness. You're experiencing stillness now. And then, like, inevitably, the movement starts happening. And the point is your awareness, or, you know, Rigpa, or whatever you want to call it, is the ability to sort of maintain an even, a continual awareness of either of those. But the sequence sort of seems to confirm what you're saying. You experience the container first.
Right. The stillness is the container.
Question?
Well, they give, Mipham gives right here, practice Mahamudra and experience stillness, occurrence, and awareness. So he identifies them, and in many other texts, these are three different things, so to speak.
Right, so in that framework of the three, where do you put, I tend to think of the awareness more as that sort of broader one that you're associating with the stillness, I guess. So I where do you put the awareness then in that framework?
The awareness is wisdom.
Prajna, right?
Is prajna.
It's looking.
So there's the stillness is the container, and then there's different types of movement.
And the awareness.
And so the still mind is always there, but we don't have an experience of it until we practice shamatha.
I guess, I mean, I have to admit, I think that the awareness is that which we, that is the sort of the overall screen or the background or whatever that you're calling container, and that's what we're not, you know, that what's generally missing is the awareness. That awareness is what's missing in general.
Well, then how do you understand the triad that he goes through of stillness, occurrence, and awareness?
I tend to think of the stillness as being the, you know, even though, as you say, there may never be a truly no movement mind, but the relatively less non-movement mind, where, you know, so that's my understanding, is when there's not specific happening, when you don't have thoughts.
So let me present my further thinking on the evidence for this, which is that the fundamental beginning exercise that we've, I think, probably all heard is, where is your mind? What is the shape of your mind? And what is the color of your mind? Right? This is like the main introductory practice for Vipassana, is looking for your mind. Which, if you know anything about Abhidharma, is a ridiculous exercise. Because the mind is what?
Empty
and
luminous. Not matter.
It's not empty and luminous. Mind
not
is
matter.
It's not matter. And only matter has location, shape, form, and color, right? So why would they say to look for something that's immaterial as if it was material? Why would they say that?
To look at the looker. Who's looking?
Well, I think it's first for people to truly experientially understand that what it means to say that mind does not matter, because even though we may understand that in a categorical point of view intellectually, I think part of the point of that exercise is to do it experientially and recognize it more thoroughly. Because that's just a concept.
That it had to do with really understanding through and through the insubstantiality of what goes on in that mind.
I think you need to speak louder if you wish others that are not in the room to hear you.
Have to say that again?
No, it's okay. So the exercises in the Vipassana section, and one of these packets I gave like an outline of the darkness of Mahamudra, dispelling the darkness, and it's so you can see like what is the structure of the practice. And let's see if I can find that real quick, but I can't. But it's very simple. The Vipassana practice in many of these manuals goes through the following categories. It goes through analyzing the still mind and the moving mind, analyzing or looking. They use the phrase either looking or pointing out the still mind and the moving mind, the still mind and the thinking mind, the still mind and the sense perceptions, the still mind, and the emotions. And in all of them, the practice starts with identifying the two as different and then realizing that they're not separate. And so I think what they're getting at is what you guys have been saying, I think, is that we have this very strong conceptual predilection to thinking that our mind has different aspects and parts to it. And so they're exaggerating that ignorance, the ignorance of thinking that our mind has different aspects. They're exaggerating that as if the mind was something that could be divided into different parts. Because that's what our experience is. We experience our mind as if it has a watcher and a watched. And the watcher and the watched are not separate. And so these exercises are used to exaggerate that sensation so that we can see our illusion clearly and thereby get to the root of the problem. Cynthia.
Yeah, I definitely agree that looking at, you know, how we see them as separate and recognizing, but isn't it in a sense they say they're not different in essence, and with the analogy of like water and waves or things like that, but there is still the sense of waves manifest a little bit differently than the bottom of the ocean, but that they're all water. So, I mean, that's a common way that they talk about this seeming difference, but also the same, is that there's the same in essence, but that one, yeah, anyway, that's.
Yeah, so, thank you. That's good.
So we have the container, which is the stillness. We have movement, occurrences. Where does awareness fit in? Is it the awareness of those occurrences, or just?
Yeah, so let's all grapple with that for a moment. You know, we have the still mind and all these different types of movement. And so where's awareness? And it's clearly stated in this text and many others that there's this triad. And let's see, he explains them a little bit. I didn't read the end of the first paragraph. He says, okay, here's the practice. Apply the key instructions. First, the basis of all things is mind. Have a conviction that we have to focus on mind, that that's the focus. You know, to cut to the chase is focus on mind. You could start with focusing on body and speech, and it would just take longer, which doesn't mean that we ignore body and speech, but it means that primarily we focus on mind. We focus on body and speech to the extent that they support our exploration of the mind. After understanding the mind's secret, and what is the mind's secret again?
The nature of mind?
The nature of mind. What about the nature of mind is secret?
Empty.
That it's empty and present at the same time, basically. That it's unoriginated and yet it feels like it's there. This is the secret of mind, is that it's the most closest thing that we experience, and therefore the most obvious example of a contradictory experience, which we constantly overlook. We constantly dismiss as, oh, it's not a problem, that this doesn't make any sense. Let's focus on other things that are parked up.
Like a fish being worried about the water. It's like it doesn't even exist there.
Right.
Could you say that in some ways that ongoing contradictory experience is the essence of the dukkha, that fundamental, you know?
I guess so, yeah. It's like thinking that we're here.
But isn't it also like the duality part? I mean, you have this experience that you think part of it is me and part of it is everything else.
Yeah. The Sorry?
Doesn't it seem like the actual awareness experience, the other thing I get totally hung up on is the diligence and discipline that's required to supposedly maintain this continual awareness. And then the other instruction is you can't do that. It has to just happen spontaneously.
Right. Mm-hmm. Think, don't think.
Pay attention.
Let go. Kelsa.
I just want to say, I think that the word container can be a little bit confusing because it's almost like a containerlessness container. It's like it's an empty container. So it can't actually hold anything, but like an ocean, I feel like to Cynthia's point, an ocean, you could say that's a container, but it's so vast that to use that term, it suggests something that it's not. And so it does hold something, but the vastness is like exponential, right? I don't know. That term, I think, is like, it's super helpful, but it also could be a little bit misleading.
Yeah, it points to mind only. So
the point I'm trying to make with the term container mm-hmm. is that that it's identical to the ocean in that there's water everywhere and then there's stuff in it.
You use the word environment.
And I also use the word environment.
Yeah. What's outside the container?
There's we have no idea, no experience. It's everything.
Sorry, I just wanted to hear, so when you said that your experience of the container, it's because it's just everything that's in it. It's holding everything.
Yeah.
Right.
After understanding the mind secret, seek the vital point of your mind.
Seek the vital point.
Seek the vital point of your mind, and you will become skilled in all things and realize the meaning of egolessness. What would be the vital point of your mind? Vital point, that's like the life heart or something, or the source.
Or...
Yeah,
tough.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
He said he would think that that was an indication of the empty yet present quality of the mind, that that's the vital point. It could be also, where does the mind go astray? Where does the illusion, ignorance happen?
Solidifies.
Right, reifying. Creating other, thinking there's something else.
Yeah, so where does that happen? That's the vital point of the mind, is understanding co-emergence. Where's the co-emergence happening? Where's wisdom turning into ignorance? If I can find that point of my mind, I can turn off the ignorance. And you will become skilled in all things and realize egolessness. Since I'm teaching according to the oral instructions of the realized ones, I will leave out various logical investigations.
Yeah, really.
Okay. Stillness is when you look into your mind, direct yourself inward, and remain devoid of any kind of thinking.
Wait, are you still in the same 1, 2, 3?
No, I'm reading a text by Meepam Rinpoche.
Okay, but you were talking about focus on the mind, understand mind secret, seek vital point of your mind, and now is this number 4?
No, this is that was just a setup for what he's about to say.
That was the setup. Okay.
Yeah, that's setting the context.
Thank you. Okay.
And then the actual practice is looking into your mind, directing yourself inward, and remaining devoid of any kind of thinking.
Doesn't that seem like different than what you were saying?
It does. Yeah. The words do, but.
that's always been the whole bugbear here, is like somehow thinking and not thinking, all the various forms of thinking and not thinking are supposed to almost be equal, and we're just kind of like letting that all go and not building stories out of the thinking, but also not avoiding it. But then if somebody comes along and acts like not thinking is a superior state of being.
I think it's mistranslated. I think, like, if I could word it this way, stillness is the aspect of mind that's devoid of thinking that we find when we look inward into our mind.
But if you read the whole three, I mean, I have to admit, I'm down with Meepam here and how he said it, of course, could be translation, but He's talking about stillness and the relative absence of thinking, and then he talks about occurrence as thoughts, and then he talks about the third one being awareness, which is being aware of those other two, whichever they may be, which, and they are equally neither good nor bad.
Yeah, so, you know, at the end of the day, you have to understand these yourself and figure out how to practice this, you know. And to some extent, if you go one way, you come to the conclusion that I can't work on occurrence until I have stillness, until I have really experienced stillness. I can't go to the next step. And I'm trying to describe that that's not accurate. Could do me a favor and hold for a minute and let's go through it. These three things, the way he describes them, and then we can talk about them. Occurrence is when various kinds of thoughts arise, and I would retranslate that as occurrence is the arising of various kinds of thoughts. And then awareness is your mind being conscious of either of these. If you maintain this continuously, so what does that mean if you maintain this continuously?
Being aware.
If you maintain this awareness of either of these aspects, you come to understand the following vital point. Various feelings such as joy and sadness arise from your own mind and dissolve back into your mind. Understanding this, you will come to recognize that all experiences are the personal experiences of your mind. Subsequently, by looking directly into the essence of your mind, whether it is still or thinking, you will understand that it is empty, and even though it perceives many things, it does not possess any entity whatsoever. This is called, and this so-called emptiness is not a blank void like space. Rather, you come to understand that it's an emptiness endowed with all the supreme aspects, which is a sort of highfalutin way of saying it's luminous. And that means it does not possess any self-nature, yet it has an unceasing clarity that is fully conscious and cognizant. When realizing the secret point of mind, although there is no separate watcher or something watched, to experience the naturally luminous and innate mind essence is known as recognizing awareness. This is what is pointed out in both the Mahamudra and Dzogchen. So initially we identify these three experiences of mind, stillness, occurrence, and awareness. And then the conclusion is there is no separate watcher or something watched, to experience the naturally luminous and innate mind essence is known as recognizing awareness. So all three are not separate. The stillness is not separate from the awareness, is not separate from the movement. And they're all three present at the same time. So the stillness doesn't obstruct the movement, and the movement doesn't obstruct the stillness.
The problem we're like prioritizing and judging and think is better than that, I'm going to reject that.
That's what we usually do, yeah. Okay. And this is trying to show that whether it's still or moving, it's the same.
So maybe like they're all together, sort of like an embroidery or something, you know, like three different colors of red, green, blue.
Yeah. They're all interwoven.
Not really different.
Yeah.
That's the same reason. All this, and no wonder we have so many different ways of looking at it, like containers. One's a container, yeah. Those are all conceptualizations that we apply to it to try to get a handle on the fact that we don't understand that all that the two of them are the same.
They lead into each other.
Yeah.
Madhyamaka Alankara.
The light goes on. Right? The synthesis, yeah. So one more comment and then we'll go on. Oh, Cynthia, did you have something? First, Kelsey. Here.
Whichever. Did. I was just going to say the notion of isolates I have found sort of helpful in sometimes when we talk about these things that are both different and the same. And when Elizabeth sort of explained the notion of isolates, which is, it seems sort of helpful that it is a sort of making distinctions of different qualities, but yet it allows you to understand them a little bit as being all part of the same as well. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, I think, right?
Yeah, that mind is one thing and has these different aspects, which from a certain point of view of technical, logical language are called isolates. It's a great term.
I don't know why, but it's helpful, yeah, a little bit.
You know, the main thing I think that we're coming down to and maybe expressing it in two different ways, but is I think we're agreeing that stillness and occurrence are not different. And so one doesn't obstruct the other. You don't have to have absence of movement in order to find stillness. That occurrence happens within stillness. And stillness accompanies occurrence. And in the Vipassana sections of the text, they say that the text, there's some texts that give you just the questions, like look at the nature of this, look at the nature of the still mind and the moving mind, and look at the awareness, look at sense perceptions, you know, look at these, look. And then there's some texts that give you the answer, so to speak, in terms of like...
You should always get those.
We should always get those books. It's like, what are you supposed to then understand? And they always say that these are not two different things. And so the vital point is that we have this experience, very tangible experience of these things as if they were separate things. That our mind, in effect, has parts to it. Even though we know the mind has no materiality, we act and feel as if it has materiality and has these different aspects. The stillness, whether we consider that a container or just like some different part of the mind.
Also how we think of the like self and other, like self is the stillness or the container.
Yeah.
That's my question.
Yeah, sorry.
No, just because it has to do with that.
Cool.
Will you just speak about this super fascinating sentence that speaks exactly about what we're talking about? The luminous creative energy of original mind is misperceived as the dualistic world of self and other. I'm like, if I understand that, I'll get it all. Just explain, yeah. How is that luminous creative energy of original mind? Like, I mean, I think that the implication is that once you understand the nature of original mind, you'll see how you're creating duality and how clearly they're the same. But like any other,
it's more than that. It's more than that. You will understand how we create the projection of a world, and that's a big leap for most of us because we don't think that everything is mind. But in all of this stuff, that's the fundamental view upon which they do all these practices, that everything is mind.
So in the Mahamudra practice, that's why we keep going back and forth, shamatha and vipassana, till you finally see it, right? Back, forth, back.
So, and
I have a question.
Oh, hold on with Sue. One second. We got Nancy in the room here.
Okay, so everything is mind. So how, you know, I mean, if we were like in Gaza right now and we've got some bombs in this and you lost a leg and a limb and you die and whatever, and yes, it's just how I see it, but there's something happening in the world. So
right, that you beautifully identified the difference between the idea that everything is in your mind versus the way that they are viewing that everything is an experience of mind. So what you're saying is like, if everything is mind, then like, how do you explain, you know, these horrific experiences that are very real?
that others can see, because there's a
how do we
state.
All how do we all experience the same thing? We all agree that we're here in a room, you know. How does, if it's all in my mind? And so they're not saying it's all in my mind, but they're saying there's nothing separate from mine. And I don't know, it would take a very long time, at least for me, to try to express my limited understanding of that.
So like,
but it's
kind of
a very different thing. And which is why it's not helpful to like really go, even though it's the foundation of this and it comes up in these statements here and there, it's actually not crucial to do in the practice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of, you know, if you're interested in what are they talking about, then you can, it requires a bunch of reading and studying to understand. Cynthia.
Yeah, I mean, the key thing is just that it's not denying experience. The notion that everything is coming from mind, whether you think of it as coming through mind or being experienced by mind or however you interpret that, whether you even interpret it, no matter at all. The key
so it's easy to say what it's not. It's a little harder to say, so what does it mean?
So mind is a reflection of what's out there, like a mirror. But if you see a flame in a mirror, touch the flame, there's no heat. It's not a real.
And that's very different than actually putting your hand in a fire.
or if you take a lens where you reproduce the image
so,
upside down and backwards. But
so we have 16 minutes left. So let's not get distracted into a philosophical discussion. Let's try to focus our remaining very short period of time on, how about this? Based on this framework of the practice of Mahamudra, as having Mahamudra Shamatha, Mahamudra Vipassana, I've talked through Vipassana as being understanding that these supposed differences in our experience of our mind are not actually real, correct experiences of our mind. We think our mind has these different aspects, like the perceiver, the awareness, and then something that it's aware of. And basically that is seen to be an incorrect reality, first through experience and then through realization, or actually first through understanding and so forth. And the Mahamudra Shamatha is a progressive exploration of the still quality of mind, or aspect or part of mind, is cultivating an experience of the still mind. And it's done through three stages of shamatha, with a concrete object, meaning like shamatha with something external, something tangible, and then shamatha with something intangible, internal. And there's various varieties of these. Sometimes it's like the second stage of shamatha is only things that are inside our body, like visualizing syllables and stuff in our body. Sometimes it's portrayed as the second type of shamatha is just objects like the breath that are not that literally concrete. So those two are presented in slightly different ways in different texts, but universally, the third stage of shamatha is shamatha without a support, without a concrete object, without a clearly defined object mode of awareness. And again, it also has different terms. Some texts it's called shamatha on the essence, meaning the essence of mind. And sometimes it's called shamatha without support, shamatha without characteristics. Different terms, but I think what I'm trying to get to is that the way Trungpa Rinpoche presents meditation practice is actually a presentation of going through these three stages without him explicitly saying that, where we start with focusing on the body posture and the breath, identifying and labeling thoughts. So the body, the breath, at least the body is a concrete experience. The breath, whether that's concrete or in non-concrete or not, I'm not sure, but it's in that range. And identifying thoughts is sort of also in the area of intangible supports of some kind. And then he progresses into mixing mind with breath, mixing mind with space. So then he uses the experience of space as a way to lead us into shamatha without object, because space is not a literal object, it's a figurative term that's meant to point to the absence of actual objects. And so shamatha on space is equivalent to saying shamatha on the nature of mind or the essence or shamatha without object.
So what happens, I mean, I always think of shamatha as sort of coming back to an object. So if you don't have an object to come back to, what is that? Is that
Well, in that third type of shamatha without object, it's getting to the experience where you're never drawn away, because there's nothing to draw you away, and there's nothing to come back to. But you maintain constant mindfulness. So you'll see in the material I circulated and in many, many other texts, this enormous emphasis on non-distraction and constant mindfulness, even though there's no object. Nancy.
When Trungpa Rinpoche first came, I mean, you described this, the way he taught was without that object. You were just resting in the present.
Yeah, in the very beginning, he was trying to introduce students right away. Totally.
We're going?
Totally.
Resting in whatever is arising.
He basically sat in front of people and gave them the opportunity to connect to his experience, his state of mind, without any description. Many people would say that he didn't give any instruction. And the idea was to sit with him and try to just, like, you know, catch his vibe, so to speak.
He was teaching this.
Oh, yeah. And some people he would just say, like, relax. Like many, I've heard a number of people tell me he would just say to them, just relax. And then he would say, like, that's it. Like where you would had let go a little bit, right, and just could connect into his energy. And then later on he began to give more and more structure to his presentation, until it in 79 it became this full-blown traditional presentation of the nine stages of shamatha, the six powers of shamatha, and the obstacles and the antidotes to shamatha. So what I've tried to do in these sessions and in the readings for them is focus us on that experience of shamatha without object. And I think the reason that I'm doing that is because I feel like we're all familiar with that, because that's the basic presentation that we've gotten over the years from Trungpa Rinpoche. The progression is to experiencing being sustaining or abiding or dwelling in the clear mindfulness without an object other than space. And he calls this panoramic awareness, and then he calls that vipassana, which is very confusing. And we could talk at great length about that. But if you compare his presentations of panoramic awareness with shamatha without an object, I think you'll see that they are identical, basically. And so just really briefly, we have 8 minutes left. The last page of today's handout gives you a really wonderful listing of major little key instructions of how to experience Mahamudra Shamatha without support that Punlin Rinpoche distributed at programs that he did way back in 2003 and 2004. I believe I got this at a program he did in New York City Shambhala Center around that time. And we don't have time to go through it today. We'll revisit it. The text before that, if you flip back, I gave you sort of by mistake. I gave you a rather intense Dzogchen text called Opening Opening the Door to Liberation. That was a little bit of a mistake. It's not a big deal. I mean, it's a publicly available text. And it's one of these self-secret things where it's like, whoa. Yeah, it's very much a Dzogchen text that has guru yoga with a sort of extensive dissolving of the visualization of the guru into Om Aham. And I thought, okay, let's give a taste of that. I saw that, and then I didn't see the search for shamatha based on attributes. The examples he used are unique to Dzogchen, using the blue letter Om. So I would not encourage you to do those.
This is
a Dzogchen presentation of the three aspects of the different types of shamatha. So Dzogchen also does this way of presenting shamatha, usually of two types, of with attributes or support and without, as we see here. It's with attributes and without. But the section on preserving the shamatha without attributes is what I meant to provide for today. And so please read that and study that, and I think you will find that very helpful.
Did you send to us digitally?
The long version. Yeah. And so what you have a copy of in your hand is the full version. But I'm suggesting that you focus in your exploration of that text, and because we didn't get to it today, we'll come back to it the next time we meet, is the section called Preserving the Shamatha Without Attributes. And I also neglected to put pagination on the text, on the package. That's sort of my hallmark. So, everybody able to find that section, Preserving the Shamatha Without Attributes? If you flip from the back of the package inward a few pages, you'll find it.
Mine's the page. It has pages.
Well, the package I circulated today, I corrected it.
Oh, okay.
Sort of sneak. I was being sneaky, right? I gave you a version 2. I said it's the corrected version. It has pagination, and it cuts out those other sections of the text, the open door to whatever it is called.
Okay, so we should go back and read the first one then. Joking. Yeah. So you're saying page 12, the bottom, is what you're recommending.
On today's version of the package.
In the new version, yeah.
Thank you. Any final comments?
Great.
So, you know, it's hard to... Thank you. Good. Yeah. It's hard to do this when the weather is so nice, you know, but we have a pretty good turn.
I have a comment.
Oh, okay. Debbie.
Yeah, so I read your original version that you sent to us on May 12th, and it was missing a page on the part that you're saying that you really wanted us to have about shamatha without attributes. But my comment is, I just felt like this was like the Sadhana Mahamudra. I mean, I liked it.
Yeah, it's definitely amazing. It's an amazing little text that presents in a very short period of time.
It's a practice. It's a practice.
Yeah, it's amazing. Barbara.
I just wanted to thank whoever fixed the... sound, it was fantastic today. Could hear.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, and the appreciation for that actually starts with a woman in the room here today, Kelsa. Thank you so much, Kelsa. Kelsa's been so helpful in our organization in many ways, and I want to recognize that. No, it's great. It's great. So Kelsa came to the first one a few months ago and was like, "We should do something with the sound, you know, and couldn't we?" Spend a few bucks to get something, and collaborated with Warner, and Kelsa has recommended a specific item. I think he got something similar as it. So Warner got something and went ahead and bought it for the organization, and here we are using it. So thank you, Kelsa. That was only one of the many things she's done. Another one is that Kelsa suggested, hey, you know, maybe this website that you guys have could be a little more accessible, just a little more. So I don't know if anyone's been to the Rime Shader website in any recently, but it's dramatically different. Ooh, and we have Kelsa's inspiration to thank. I'm so grateful to you for that and helping like reshape
it. Can we see her face?
Oh, what a great idea. Kelsa, thank you.
Oh, so okay. Much.
And it's actually not done. We haven't really implemented the full capabilities of that template in Squarespace. It's waiting for me, of course, to do a bunch of things. And then Morgan did the actual footwork of changing, transferring over, and so forth. So he did a great job in that. Please check it out if you haven't. And Kelsa has done many other things for us, including creating a community here on our Sunday mornings, which used to end with a bang and everybody just disappearing. So grateful to you for that. Thank you.
It's more like it was before when people like,
yeah.
have...
Yeah, and that's so helpful for people to bond and connect in that way, yes. Yeah. So the question is would people be up for doing this again in June, or should we wait till the fall? So I'll send out like a doodle and with the date, I think. I'm trying not to do the first Sunday in June because it's something else.
It's Father's Day is one Sunday in June.
And we want to avoid that. Is it the second one? I thought it's the third. So there's June 9th is the possibility. Does anybody know Father's Day offhand?
It's not the 19th
or 20th.
The 16th. Yeah. So June 9th is the prospective next date for this. So I'll circulate that. If people are up for it, I'll be more than happy to do it. So thank you,
everyone. You all, I'll be driving across three states.
Okie doke. Wouldn't want you to have an accident. So thank you very much. Let's dedicate the merit. By this merit, may all attain a mission state to defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves and earthbound agents. The ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the deities, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon system bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you. Nice, really nice to see everyone. Take care.
Bye bye.